It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, math and geometry may bring back memories of school and only school. But our next guest says that math is part of the fabric of our daily lives. We'll talk to UW-Madison math professor Jordan Ellenberg about his latest book, Shape, the Hidden Geometry of Information, Biology, Strategy, Democracy, and Everything Else. First, there are computer chips in just about every electronic thing you own. Your computer, your phone, car, maybe even your big appliances. Over the course of the pandemic, there's been an ongoing chip shortage in the global supply chain, making it tough for manufacturers and companies to make the amount of stuff that consumers want to buy. It's now gone on long enough that prices on some consumer goods are going up. General Motors is making 500,000 fewer vehicles because of the shortage. Microsoft struggling to make enough Xbox consoles and Surface laptops. And Apple's CEO has warned that the supply limits could impact sales of their stuff. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you work in an industry that's been hit by the chip shortage? Have you been trying to purchase any of these things we've been talking about? A car, electronics, whatever it might be? Are you seeing higher prices or limited availability? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Willie Shi is a professor of management practice in business administration at Harvard Business School and is part of the Technology and Operations Management Unit. He's the co-author of the book, Producing Prosperity, Why America Needs a Manufacturing Renaissance. Willie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Pleased to be here.
We're in the midst of this global chip shortage. First, can you tell us about what these chips do, why they're in so many things that we buy?
Well, chips are everywhere now. They're used very widely in automobiles, of course, but they're also used in a lot of appliances, like washing machines, even, you know, fancy toaster ovens, but exercise machines, and of course, notebook computers and all those things that we use for work at home, right? So they're everywhere now because so much of the complicated functions you like to do, it's much easier to do them in hardware, or I mean in software, and then have them, you know, controlled by microcontroller chips. It's much cheaper and you can get much fancier functions. So they're really everywhere, and that's just on a path to continue growing.
Why did the pandemic restrict the flow of these chips?
Well, it's a complicated story. Okay, now, for one thing, we had a rise in demand for work from home things. I mean, we had a rush of people buying notebook computers, things so that they could use Zoom or Microsoft Teams or whatever. So a lot of demand for computers, a lot of demand for displays, also a lot of demand for home entertainment equipment like the new Sony PlayStation and games and exercise equipment and things like that. Now, where we really started getting a lot of attention on this chip shortage, of course, was the auto industry. Okay. And I think underneath that, it tells a very interesting story. Let me start with what the global auto market looks like today, right? Because China is the world's largest auto market. They probably manufacture twice as many vehicles over there that we do in the U.S., okay? And what's really interesting, and most people don't realize, is China vehicle sales kind of peaked in 2017, and 2018 and 19, they were down, right? So going into January 2020, the outlook for the China market was already down. So you can imagine, it's like, okay, maybe I don't need to order as many chips. Okay. Then, of course, the pandemic hits. Okay. And in China, in February of 2020, sales dropped 82%. Okay. Now, we caught up in March and April. In March, in Europe, sales dropped 46%, and they dropped 80% in April. And in the U.S., by April, sales dropped 52%. Okay, so now we tend to forget, but back in those days, the automakers were worried about, gee, we don't want to go bankrupt again. I mean, the big three in Detroit, we don't want to go bankrupt again, right? So what they did is they cut back a lot of their chip orders. Okay, and people were saying, well, you know, we really don't need as many, so let's not pay for them, right? We got to conserve cash. And then as a consequence, meanwhile, you had all this demand for notebook computers and work from home and play at home and what have you. And a lot of those manufacturers just soaked up that manufacturing capacity for chips. So then by the time the auto market started to pick up again last summer, all of a sudden there wasn't the capacity to make those chips. And that's when we first started noticing that. Okay, now there have been a couple other things that have happened. There have been fires at two semiconductor plants in Japan. Okay, and then we also did a couple other things that caused companies to start stockpiling chips. So, for example, we sanctioned some Chinese companies, or there was a threat of sanctions last year. So they started stockpiling chips because they wanted to stay in business. So what happened is you have this ferocious demand, increasing stockpiling, and then the automakers got caught short. So that's where we saw it first. Okay, but then this shortage has just kind of kept building as more people have sort of said, maybe I better order a couple more of those chips, right, and get them in inventory. And now that stockpiling, nobody will admit they're stockpiling, okay, but you know, a lot of companies are ordering more than they need, right? And so now we have this distribution where the chips and the capacity is not necessarily where it needs to be.
Talking to Willie Shih from Harvard Business School about a computer chip shortage that may be affecting sales at a car lot, computer store, appliance store. The list goes on near you. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a question for our guest and experience shopping for something with computer chips in it that there's a long wait for, or if you're in an industry that is seeing these slowdowns, love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Willie, easy solution. There's not enough chips. Let's build a factory and start making them quick. What's wrong with that?
Well, nice idea, but the problem is to build a factory and get all the equipment in and get it running, that probably takes, if you're in Asia, you might be able to do it in a little over a year. You know, in the US or in Europe, it might take you 2 years to get something like that going. Okay. And especially if you're going to make chips for, say, the auto industry, the automaker, you know, has to kind of certify that factory and they have to qualify it. Is the process they usually talk about. It's like, okay, I need to know your quality plans are good enough that, you know, you can make these chips for me, right? So there's a long process of getting the plant up and qualified. And then after you do that, to actually put the chip in to the factory and have it built, it's going to take, you know, 60 days to, you know, by the time you're done packaging and going through the whole supply chain, it might take as long as, you know, a couple of months, maybe as long as 3, 4, 5, 6 months, right? So that takes time. Okay. Now, we did have a lot of calls by governments in the US and Germany, for example, to Taiwanese manufacturers and say, hey, how about allocating some more of that capacity to our auto industry? And the Taiwanese factories, they're called fabs, or they're called foundries, the companies who make them, have allocated more. But guess what? That probably took that capacity away from somebody else.
Now, Will, you wrote about this back in March of 2020. And A, you said we're going to be feeling the impact of this supply disruption for a long time. So well done there. But you also point out maybe a fundamental problem, even pre-pandemic, a lot of industries relying on some form of just-in-time manufacturing, meaning I don't want to have a lot of money tied up in inventory, a warehouse full of these chips waiting for whenever. I'm going to have a short supply because I know there's a constant flow coming from Taiwan or wherever. Is it time to start rethinking that philosophy?
Well, I think so. This whole just-in-time philosophy really came from Toyota, which taught the world about the value of not having a lot of inventory and having suppliers deliver frequently when you need it. What people forget is that when Toyota sets up their manufacturing, their suppliers are nearby, right? If you go to Toyota City in Nagoya, Japan, you know, the suppliers are all, you know, 15 minutes away or an hour away. They're not very far away. Even if you go to, for example, Toyota in Georgetown, Kentucky, okay, they have an enormous number of suppliers within their state, within the state of Kentucky. Okay, now what happened is a lot of people said, hey, this just in time, let me reduce my cash tied up in inventory. I can extend that. Okay, I can extend it around the world because I have reliable global logistics. Well, that was great until the pandemic came, and then we see all these disruptions in the logistics and supply chains, right? A lot of chips are flown by air, right? And for example, when the pandemic hit, international air travel ground to a halt. That immediately took out 50% of the capacity for international air cargo because it travels in the bellies of air passenger planes, mm-hmm. right? So we had made these assumptions around just-in-time inventory on the basis of reliable, predictable logistics, okay? We sort of took it for granted. Well, maybe that wasn't such a great assumption. It certainly wasn't a very resilient assumption.
We're talking to Willie Shi, professor of management practice and business administration at Harvard Business School. We're looking at a computer chip shortage and supply chain logistics during the pandemic and what it all means when we want to buy or make things with those computer chips. A lot of disruptions now, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Is your employer, your job being impacted by something going wrong in the supply chain? Have you had trouble buying a product that's been back-ordered or out of stock for a while? Do you work on some form of sales floor where you're having to give customers bad news about the availability of the things they want to buy? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation now with Willie Shi, professor of management practice in business administration at Harvard Business School, part there of the Technology and Operations Management Unit, looking at a shortage of key computer chips that go into things like cars, phones, appliances, and more. Big shortage affecting the supply of those things. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this affecting your industry, your workplace right now? Do you have questions about how the supply chain works in general? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Willie, in addition to that just-in-time philosophy we were talking about, keeping a limited supply on hand, I understand that some of these key goods are produced by, you know, just one or two companies, and they rely on products to make these chips that are made just by one or two companies. Are we counting too much on individual firms here?
Well, Rob, one of the problems is a lot of people didn't realize this. Okay, so and that's because of the structure of these supply chains. So, for example, let's say you're an auto manufacturer who will go to a big tier one supplier like Bosch or Continental or somebody like that for some of your components, okay? And those guys will in turn go to maybe a subcontractor to assemble boards, circuit boards that have chips on them. And then they'll buy the chips from one of these chip suppliers. And in the case of the automotive chips, would be somebody like NXP Semiconductor or Texas Instruments or ST Micro or somebody like that. And then those guys, sometimes they'll make the chips themselves, but sometimes they'll go to one of these Taiwanese foundries. Okay. And what people have discovered is, oh, you know, I might have been buying from multiple sources, but when I go all the way down multiple layers in the supply chain, I end up at the same place. All right. You know, now the world has learned that lesson before. Back in 2011, when there was this earthquake and tsunami, you know, the Tohoku East Japan earthquake and tsunami, when everybody who painted cars black in the world found out that that shiny black pigment came from one factory in that area. Okay. And Toyota sort of learned a lesson then, too, because they were depending on a lot of chips that came from a factory then. Mm. So they went and, you know, had more inventory. And a lot of people then said, well, we need to diversify more. But because of this layered structure, multiple tiers in the supply chain, a lot of people don't know that in the end, we all depend on the same suppliers.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Daniel is with us in Kimberly. Daniel, hi.
Hi.
What'd you want to bring up, Daniel?
Yeah. So my name is Daniel. I'm from Kimberly, Wisconsin. I actually just graduated high school here in Kimberly. I'll be a freshman at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, looking to double major in astrophysics and aerospace engineering. And so I'm going to need a computer while I'm there at school. So I was looking, and I just built a desktop computer so I could use that for some of my course requirements. But looking for parts, I was just at a loss. You couldn't find anything. Everything was like double, triple of what the regular retail price was, because a lot of people are scalping some of these parts. So I was lucky enough, I had a friend who had some parts, so I got them secondhand. And then on the other hand, you've got a lot of people scalping these Xboxes and PlayStations and computer parts and reselling them. And then at the same time, a lot of those parts are in shortage, as people are buying a lot of them to use for things like Bitcoin mining productions and other things like that. So I'm just wondering if there's really a solution to maybe something like that, or like if there's an alternative for Bitcoin miners. I mean, why are they doing things like this?
Daniel, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for sharing your experience. Bitcoin is a whole nother conversation, but that's the sort of thing Daniel's bringing up that is being affected here, Willie.
Well, yeah, Daniel, first of all, congratulations on what you're going to be doing. We need more engineers like that. Okay, but you know, one of the problems, if you think about it, is if you're going to build a notebook computer, okay, or you're going to build an Xbox or something like that, you only need to be missing one part, right? And if you think about, like a phone or a computer, like I think a phone has anywhere from 2,000 to 4,000 parts. You only need to be missing one. A lot of the shortages are in these kind of prosaic categories of like, oh, I never worried about that, like timer controller chips. One of the things that's in big shortage right now is what are called display driver chips. These are the chips that take the signal and put that image on that screen on your notebook or on your TV or things like that. So there are a lot of these little chips, okay, that sometimes they only cost, you know, a dollar or 50 cents or sometimes maybe $2. They don't cost a lot, but if you don't have it, then you can't assemble the product. You know, in the industry, they talk about, am I clear to build this thing, right? Do I have all the parts that I need? And when they're not clear to build, a lot of manufacturers will say, you know, I'm going to pay extra if I need to get those chips, because otherwise I can't build a whole product. And when that happens, you know, that means their costs increase. This is all being aggravated by people who are saying, just in case, I'm going to buy more inventory, right? So that's putting more demand on the manufacturer. So it's kind of a vicious cycle. The only advice I can give you, Daniel, right, and I know this is not very timely for those who are going back to school and they need their notebook computer. If you can hold on, it's inevitable that we're going to have surpluses of these things down the road sometime. So that'll be a good time to buy it because it'll be marked down. But I can't give you much relief until then.
Daniel, thanks a lot for the call. Good luck with the fall semester. Let's go now to Diane in New Auburn. Diane, hi. Are you there, Diane?
Yes, I am.
Hi, go ahead. You're on the air. Okay, I don't hear Diane, but our producer tells me Diane says she had to wait for a chip for a car she ordered several months ago, finally picking up Friday. Okay, so Willie, are they letting cars go without some sort of optional chips, or we can go back and get them later, or are cars just sitting around unsellable without that key chip?
Well, a lot of manufacturers are building the cars with those parts missing. And then as they get their chips, they're going back and, you know, plugging them in, which, by the way, makes the car a lot more expensive when you have to go put it out on a lot. And then I got to, you know, truck it back into the factory and put the chip back in. Initially, what a lot of manufacturers were doing is saying, I'm going to concentrate using my chips on the most expensive cars, right? The ones that I get the most for. Right. And that's why average selling prices have been going up as well. And then the shortage, by the way, the automakers have been able to hold price on these things much more. So they've been making more per car. Right. So, you know, now they would still make more if they sold more cars. But, you know, so there are a couple of things going on, which is one of them is I'm going to allocate the chips that I can get to the most valuable cars. Now, TSMC has reported that they have ramped up production. I think they said, you know, the microcontrollers that are meant for cars in the first half of this year, they grew their output by 30% and for the full year, they're forecasting to make 60% more this year than last year. And we know car demand didn't go up 60%. So there's some hoarding going on somewhere, which is making this problem worse. But I think it's going to start getting better sooner.
Now, the Biden administration is talking about wanting to get more of these chips made here in the United States. And as you said earlier, that's not going to solve the problem next month or probably even next year. But if it was a priority, a federal priority to say, okay, we want to produce these things here, is that a realistic option? Is that a thing we can do?
Well, there are a couple of confusing things that the administration wants. One is we want to produce more domestically for guys like the auto industry. Those tend not to be the leading edge chips. Okay. Those tend to be made in older foundries, which we have some in the U.S. We could build more, but that means, you know, older technology. The administration also wants leadership in the advanced chips. That's a different problem. A lot of this is just, you know, the will to invest in that kind of long cycle capacity. Okay. And there's a lot of talk about how do I subsidize companies to build more in this country. I'm a little wary of subsidies because I don't know how sustainable that is once you pull the subsidies away, right? But, you know, the administration certainly wants to see more made in the U.S. We still have a lot of policy stuff to work out to figure out how we're going to pay for that and how we're going to actually make that happen.
Hey, Willie, 30 seconds. We've talked to you in the past about Foxconn here in Wisconsin. They're looking for stuff to do. We need chips. Just half a minute. Is that something they could do there?
Well, Foxconn just bought an old 6-inch fab from a Taiwanese company because they want to start making their own auto chips. I don't think they're going to move that fab from Taiwan to the U.S. The facility in Wisconsin, they'll use for assembly of stuff, right? And, you know, they'll put it to good use. I'm pretty confident of that.
Willie, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
That's Willie Shih, professor of management practice and business administration at Harvard Business School. He's co-author of the book Producing Prosperity, Why America Needs a Manufacturing Renaissance. We talked about a global computer shortage and why we're seeing a lot of delays and shortages in the pandemic supply chain. Now, when you think back to math classes in school, you might remember having a knack for it. Or you may shudder remembering a math class that you had a tough time with. Now zoom in on geometry. Our next guest says there's a good chance that you loved it or hated it. Maybe it helped math make sense for you, or maybe it scared you away. It's why he calls it the cilantro of the math world. But either way, he says geometry is worth another visit because it can help us think about the world in interesting ways and because it shapes the world around us, from elections to games to investments and even the fundamental nature of the universe. Jordan Ellenberg is the John D. MacArthur Professor of Mathematics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. His latest book is Shape, the Hidden Geometry of Information, Biology, Strategy, Democracy, and Everything Else. He talked to us back in June. Here's a listen to that conversation. What is it about geometry that has sort of a love it or hate it reaction from a lot of people, do you think?
Well, it's really different from everything else in the high school math curriculum, and I think people instinctively sense that. I think, you know, one thing about it is that geometry is really in our body in a way that maybe algebraic manipulations of numbers are not. We are built to kind of look at things, see how they're shaped, see where they are in relation to each other, and see how they're moving.
And we'll get into a lot of the practical applications of geometry. But one thing that emerges pretty quickly in your book is, I don't know, there's kind of a state of mind, a mental habit, best exemplified by someone I didn't know was a geometry nerd in American history, Abraham Lincoln. Can you talk about how he obsessed over geometry and how it shaped the way he expressed himself?
Yeah, I didn't know that either. And, you know, one of the fun things about writing a book like this is you go in with some idea about what you're going to write about, and then you just encounter all these crazy stories. And I think as a writer, you just got to follow those stories where they go. So one of those is the story of Lincoln, who is, you know, this is before he's president. He's a young lawyer kind of going around Illinois from court to court. And, you know, he told an interviewer later, I was constantly going into court and being asked to prove things. And I realized, I don't know what that means. What does that word even mean? What is a proof? He said, I'm going to go back and read the six books of Euclid, this kind of foundational geometric
text that our geometry class in high school is kind of the distant descendant of. You know, one thing that makes geometry different from other classes in the curriculum is that that is where we prove, right? That is where we sort of start from scratch, start from these basic axioms, and really prove real facts about the geometry of, well, of triangles and circles and line segments. Lincoln, I don't think, cared about triangles and circles and line segments that much, although he did become obsessed with the ancient problem of squaring the circle for a few days, sort of like slightly freaking out his law partners. But no, I think what he was interested in was, what does it actually mean to have proved something? What does it actually mean to have justified something that you were going to say? And that, I think, is something that he carried with him throughout his life. Now, whether it's something he got from geometry or whether it's something that was sort of already in temperament, I mean, Honest Abe, we call him, and that resonated with Euclid, that we don't really know, but it certainly meant a lot to him.
Now, geometry, among the reasons it I think is kind of strange is it, on paper, it exists in this abstract realm of the ideal planes and things like that. But then in practice, it turns out to have so many practical uses, and we're going to talk about them during the show in so many different planes of our own existence. Could you talk about that translation from abstract to reality?
Yeah, and I want to emphasize that, you know, Euclid, who was this mathematician in North Africa in the city of Alexandria around 300 CE, he described everything in this very abstract way, and that was an incredible sort of leap forward in sophistication. But people were doing geometry not because they liked abstraction. People were doing geometry and continue to do geometry because they were trying to address real world problems. I mean, one thing I say in the book again and again is that, you know, mathematics is made of people, people who are doing people things, right, who have real problems that they want to solve. And essentially, any time that you find yourself thinking in terms of which things are close to which other things, which things are far from which other things, how long is it going to take a thing from to get from here to over there? You are reasoning geometrically. You are reasoning about paths that objects take, which is a fundamentally geometric concept.
That reminds me of Raleigh on the Ideas Network Facebook says, "I enjoyed geometry class. Give me a saw, some lumber, and I can show you geometry. Algebra, I found that hard to cut." So that idea that we can practically, and you do it through your book with lots of line drawings, nothing fancy, to illustrate the points you make. That makes it kind of potentially more fun, it seems like.
Yeah, I mean, it was actually, you know, my University of Wisconsin colleague, Linda Berry, the famous cartoonist, who really gave me the idea to do that. I sort of had all these kind of hashed out drawings. And I was like, should I find like an artist to pay to make these better for me? She was like, would you hire somebody else to write the book for you? And like, no, those are yours. That kind of creates the experience of, you know, we're there together and I'm writing in a napkin, like trying to sort of show you what I'm getting at. So yeah, I'm not going to say the drawings are like Van Gogh or something, but they really hopefully kind of get that feeling of we're just kind of there talking about it conversationally and I'm drawing a sketch to trying to show you what I mean.
We're talking to Jordan Ellenberg, UW-Madison mathematics professor. His new book is Shape, The Hidden Geometry of Information, Biology, Strategy, Democracy, and Everything Else. You can join in with your geometry memories as a student, maybe as a teacher, or your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jordan, you are in Wisconsin, and a lot of your examples in your book cry out to being of Wisconsin interest. One of them is how mosquitoes move around. And this was an interesting use of geometry that ended up having results in lots of other fields. Can you tell us the mosquito story?
Yeah. So, I mean, the basic problem is this, and it comes from a famous doctor named Ronald Ross, the fellow who discovered that malaria was carried by mosquitoes. He was also sort of a wannabe mathematician and also a wannabe poet, actually, sort of a very interesting character whose story I tell in the book. But, you know, he was interested in this question of eradication. You can't make mosquitoes go extinct, as nice as that might be in a Wisconsin summer, right? But you can't do it. But what you can do is sort of clear a certain area of mosquitoes. And what Ross wanted to know is, how much time is that going to buy you? How long is it going to take mosquitoes carrying whatever it is they're carrying move back into that area. Also, already he understood, this is, we're talking about 1904 right now, he understood a principle which has been very active in this last year of grappling with a pandemic, that dealing with an epidemic is not about perfectionism. It's not about getting to zero. It's about getting the thing under control. We are probably not going to make COVID extinct any more than we can make mosquitoes extinct, but that does not mean that you give up. So that, but then you have these like very geometric, very mathematical questions, like how much time are you buying yourself if you clear a region of a certain size of mosquitoes? And this brought him into the question of the random walk, which, what is that? Well, you need to know how long it's going to take mosquitoes to get from the region you didn't clear to the region you did clear. Seems simple. You can figure out how far a mosquito can fly in a given, you can fly a mile a day. I have no idea what the real number is. Okay, so then it should take 10 days for it to get 10 miles, right? Well, that's if the mosquito flies the exact same direction in a straight line every day. But, you know, mosquitoes are not goal-oriented creatures like that, right? I mean, they just kind of do what they do. They're going to flit around at random. Maybe each day they choose a random direction to go. And now you have a much richer geometric question. If you have some being like a mosquito, which every day chooses a random direction to go in and goes that direction, well, you can imagine it's probably going to kind of move around, sort of backtracking a lot, like not really moving that far in any particular direction. Still, if you're asking yourself how you're doing with malaria control, you want to know how far it's going to get from where it started. That is a geometric question, a question about the geometry of random motion through a network or in a space. It turns out, and this is kind of what's so great about geometry, to be the same kind of mathematical question that people were asking all these different contexts, that Louis Bachelier in France was asking about stock prices. Do they just move up and down at random? That Einstein in Switzerland was asking about this physical phenomenon of Brownian motion. And now we get into a crazy story that Andrei Markov in Russia was asking, because he was trying to win like a theological argument with like another Russian mathematician who he hated. That's kind of a crazy story. I also found out about while writing this book. So all these things are different applications. And yet the underlying mathematics, the mathematics of the random walk, turns out to be just the same. This was one of the great insights of Henri Poincaré, who's a major figure in the book, who said mathematics is the art of giving the same name to different things. We see the mathematics allows us to see what's the same under the skin in contexts that look to the surface very different.
We're listening back to our chat with UW-Madison math professor and author Jordan Ellenberg. His latest book is Shape: The Hidden Geometry of Information, Biology, Strategy, Democracy, and Everything Else. You can always let us know what you think. Does geometry make sense to you? Do you use it in your work or your daily life? What do you remember about learning various forms of math in school? Do you teach it yourself? Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Or tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. In just a bit, we'll find out how geometry has changed over the centuries, the best way to teach it in the classroom, and how many holes there are in a straw. Something to think about. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're listening to our conversation from earlier this year with UW-Madison math professor Jordan Ellenberg. We talked about math, geometry, and how they shape the world around us. His latest book is called Shape: The Hidden Geometry of Information, Biology, Strategy, Democracy, and Everything Else. During our talk, we heard from Central Time listener Rick in Rhinelander. He was wondering about two different schools of geometry. Here's what he had to say.
Hello. Yes, thanks for taking my call. I have a question for the professor. I have never completely understood the distinction between Euclidean and non-Euclidean geometry, and I wonder if you could explain that in basic layman's terms.
Ooh, good question. I am looking forward to the answer too, Jordan.
Yeah, and this is something which comes up both in this book, actually, and in my last book, How Not to Be Wrong. I talk about it a little bit in both places, and it's a fascinating story. Well, Euclidean geometry, pretty simple to say what it is. It's what Euclid did, and it's the geometry that we're very familiar with. You start from these five axioms of Euclid, and those describe how figures look in the plane. But the thing is that there's one of Euclid's axioms that people always found, as I guess the kids would say today, a little bit sus. There's something strange about it. It's more complicated than the others. And people always said it would be so much better if we could show that this one followed from the others. We could find some proof of that axiom so we didn't have to assume it. we could just say it follows from the other axioms, which seem much more incontrovertible. And people tried and they tried and they tried and they tried for like literally like more than 1,000 years. And eventually people started to doubt. And they said, well, what if there was some alternate geometry in which that wasn't true? A non-Euclidean geometry, a geometry that satisfied the first four of Euclid's axioms, but not the fifth. And in the 19th century, people were able to figure out that you could invent geometries that worked like that, which had different theorems. Now, you might say, that might seem like the most useless thing mathematicians could possibly do. Why, for instance, would you study a geometry where you could have two different lines that intersected and were parallel to the same line? You just say like, well, that's evidently impossible. Nonetheless, it was very hard to use the axioms of Euclid to prove that it was impossible. And so people really worked out what would geometry be like under these alternate axioms. Okay, again, seems like an intellectually sterile alternate universe game. But guess what? The punchline is we found out that a non-Euclidean universe post-Einstein is the one that we actually live in. So, you know, we could have said, why explore this? Because that's not the way the world is. But mathematicians have a habit of really trying to work out every possible way the world could be. That's the mathematical habit. And in this case, it turned out to be a thing that we had the mathematical underpinning already ready for when Einstein and others sort of started to understand the weird way that space actually is.
Rick, thanks a lot for the question at 800-642-1234. We heard from Dee on Facebook who shared her bad memories of geometry class. She says it was not the class, but having to go up to the board and solve a problem. The pressure to be right was pretty intense. Can you share your thoughts, Jordan, on how we teach and learn geometry? We've tried a lot of different ways over the centuries.
Yeah, this is something as a teacher, of course, I think about a lot. And the cost of being wrong seems very high. You know, as a guy who wrote a book called How Not to Be Wrong, like I feel like maybe I'm partly to blame by making being wrong sound very terrible. Being wrong in the context of a class is not so terrible. I think that it's something that doesn't happen as much in other classes, right? That somebody just says like you're flat out wrong. It does happen in math. I don't think we should try to pretend that that isn't the case, but I think we should try to lower the emotional salience of that. I think a big mistake we make is try to be encouraging by telling our students like, hey, this is pretty simple. This is pretty easy. It's not simple and it's not easy, right? I mean, there's a reason that every single thing we do in a high school math classroom is something that like people worked incredibly hard over periods of hundreds of years in order to articulate in the form that we have them now. If it was simple, people would have always known those things, right? And they did not. So not, it's a challenge, but as teachers, I think we have to both say, hey, this stuff is really deep. This stuff is really hard. And if you think about it, you're going to get it wrong 3 times before you get it right, but also not be discouraging, right? This is actually hard and it's actually deep, but you can do it. And I think if we can do that, we can reduce the pain of standing up at the blackboard and being wrong, because that is going to happen. If we're really learning, we're going to be wrong sometimes.
Talking to Jordan Ellenberg, math professor at UW-Madison. His new book is Shape, The Hidden Geometry of Information, Biology, Strategy, Democracy, and Everything Else. Well, let's talk about shapes and politics, another relevant Wisconsin issue. Jordan, you spent a lot of time looking at gerrymandering, how we draw lines. What kind of tools can we borrow from geometry to assess the lines we draw on our maps?
Yeah, and I mean, this is such an interesting topic, and it's going to be one that we're going to be talking about a lot here in this state of Wisconsin over the next 6 months to a year. In fact, there was even a little bit of a squib about it in the news, like right when we were taking our break. What's funny about it is that people think they know why it's geometric because they think it's about districts that have funny shapes. And that if we could come up with a sort of a geometric definition of what constitutes a funny shape, then we could just rule those out and be done. Unfortunately, that is not how it is. With modern computational capacity, you can make a very gerrymandered district map that is engineered to give one party a huge advantage, where the districts look pretty nice. Like if you look at the map of the assembly districts we have in Wisconsin right now, that is an extremely gerrymandered map, but the shapes of the districts are perfectly okay. You can't detect it with the naked eye anymore. You need to do something more sophisticated. And in the end of the book, you know, I spend some time really getting into what are the modern geometric techniques that this kind of very interesting collaboration of lawyers and mathematicians and elected officials have come up with to really set up a system of red flags for when is a gerrymandered map too gerrymandered. And what's kind of amazing is it all comes down to the random walk. That same kind of map that Ronald Ross developed thinking about mosquitoes is exactly how we explore the space of all possible ways to cut Wisconsin into 99 pieces, a very interesting, abstract, and huge geometry.
You also waded into a debate that was huge on the internet a while back. Just in our last couple minutes, Jordan, how many holes are there in a straw?
Yeah, we should do an online poll, right? How many holes are there in a straw? You are probably thinking, because most people do, well, it's obvious. Guess what? You probably do think it's obvious, and the person standing next to you probably also thinks it's obvious, and you may have a different answer. That's what's sort of so rich about this problem. So, you know, there are one holers and there are two holers, and then there is even a sort of small stalwart population of zero holers. In the time we have left, I can't tell the whole story, but let me just say that the punchline from a modern mathematical point of view is that there are two holes in the straw, but one is the negative of the other. It's reflection. So they're different, but they're not quite independent from each other.
Jordan, just in our last minute, can you remind us that we can have some fun with geometry and math in general?
I'm a scholar. That's the only way I know how to write. So when I write, I'm not writing a textbook. I'm telling the stories of the people who made this math and why they were doing what they were doing. And people are weird and interesting. And so I don't know how to without having fun. This book is fun to write, and I hope it's fun to read.
Jordan, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on.
That was Jordan Ellenberg, the John D. MacArthur Professor of Mathematics at UW-Madison. We talked to him back in June about his latest book, Shape, The Hidden Geometry of Information, Biology, Strategy, Democracy, and Everything Else. You can still let us know what you think about geometry. Love it, can't stand it, somewhere in between. Email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us @CentralTimeWPR.